We will call the Senate Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect it's approximately 3:35 this Wednesday afternoon, January 18th, 2012. We do have a quorum with us today. To my immediate left is co-chair Senator Wagner. To my right is Senator French and Senator Wilikowski. We will be joined any minute by Senator Stedman, and then I also understand that Senator Stevens will be soon joining us. And as we speak, here is Senator McGuire, who we heard was also on our way. So we welcome you, Senator McGuire. My name is Joe Pascvan, co-chair with Senator Wagner of the Senate Resources Committee. We have in the audience with us today Senator Thomas and Senator Giesel. Welcome to the Senate Resources Committee. Today we have a very interesting presentation. It deals with heavy oil and a process that would be new technology and the application of that technology to the heavy oil universe. And as we know, across America, the issue of developing technologies has opened up a lot of resources in North America, including the shale gas revolution that started in approximately 2006, the shale oil revolution that started a few years after that, and that developed out of the horizontal drilling and fracturing technology and all the issues that are attendant with that type of technological advances. We've seen technological advances in the issue of drilling itself with the 3D and 4D seismic and all the sorts of things that have led to increase throughput in a individual well using less drill rigs, so to speak, because of the greater technology. So we have here today with us a gentleman by the name of Dr. Yarbrough, and I'll have him present his thoughts to the Senate Resources Committee, but a hearty welcome from the Senate Resources Committee to you, Dr. Yarbrough. So please state your name and whether there's any affiliation that you have with anyone on the record, and then if you could please begin your presentation. I would, before you do that, we also welcome Senator Coghill has joined us. So anyway, Dr. Yarbrough, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Senator Pascvan. My name is Stephen Yarbrough. I'm currently an employee with Los Alamos National Laboratory and owner of S&T Ventures, LLC. And I want to thank the committee for giving me the privilege and the honor for presenting to you today. I very much appreciate your time. And what I'd like today is describe to you a new technology that we've developed that we think would be beneficial for the state of Alaska. Essentially, I'll briefly talk a little bit about the problem, just to give a recap, talk about the technology, and then what I think the benefits are for the state of Alaska. But before I begin, what I'd like to do is take just a moment and tell you a little bit about myself. I started with Phillips Petroleum in the gas portion of Phillips Petroleum in the Permian Basin, so I've got some natural gas processing experience. Then I had the opportunity to go up and work for Rockwell International at their Hanford Atomics Products operations at their plutonium facility and worked there for a couple of years. From there, I was able to go to Los Alamos National Laboratory, where I've been for the past 28, and I've worked at their plutonium facility. So let me tell you kind of the unusual series of events that kind of led to this technology. While I was 10 or 15 years ago, the laboratory was working on recovering the radioactive waste in the underground waste tanks at the Hanford site. And to do that, I was part of a multidisciplinary team that was developing a supercritical water oxidation process to remove the organics from the waste so that the waste could then be sent for vitrification. So several years passed, that project was completed, and I moved from the plutonium facility to a part of the laboratory where I used my experience to analyze foreign countries' nuclear weapons programs. So I used my experience, and as part of that, I'm part of an organization that has the nuclear emergency search team, and where we go out and they go out and look at various issues worldwide. And as part of that, they developed some very high energy radiography. During the BP Gulf oil spill, the laboratory was asked to deploy that radiography to look at the well casing. so that if we had to develop explosive closure devices, that we knew exactly where to place them. So I was able to look at a lot of the real-time feeds from underwater, and I began to consider how we might use the high pressures at that depth, about 5,000 PSI, maybe to process the oil. And I reflected upon my early experience with supercritical water, and so the two came together, and now we've developed this supercritical water treatment, which takes heavy oil, essentially something with the consistency of peanut butter, and makes it the consistency of water. So you can see how that would have application to Alaska's vast heavy oil deposits. California and Alaska have billions of barrels of heavy oil that is an asset that, if developed, could be tremendous for Alaska and the United States. One of the things that's potentially holding it back, of course, is the high viscosity, which makes it difficult to pump in the Trans-Alaska pipeline. So with that background, I'll begin.
Thank you, Doctor. There's any questions that anyone may have, please feel comfortable in addressing Dr. Yarborough.
Thank you. Oh, thanks, Jeff. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here. I think you're more aware than I am of the issue with, as the conventional oil production goes down, that affects the Trans-Alaska pipeline. That drilling and finding more conventional oil is expensive. So, for example, Shell going out into the deep ocean to find the oil. And I can appreciate your sense of urgency in looking for other alternatives to maintain the pipeline, because it's very important not only to Alaska but to the United States, since they get 12% of the U.S. oil through the Alaska pipeline. Well, globally, there's huge amounts of heavy oil available, but in the past, it's been difficult to exploit. It's very hard to transport because of the high viscosity. Typically, it's $10 to $20 barrel less than conventional oil, and only about 1 in 4 U.S. refineries can really process the heavy oil. Alaska is very fortunate in that you have vast deposits of heavy oil available, somewhere between 24 to 33 billion barrels in total in the state, split up between the Schrader Bluff and West Sac and Ugnew Fields. And what's nice about the heavy oil is it is fairly shallow. So, in terms of recovering the oil, if you can overcome the viscosity issue, it's relatively easy to get. It doesn't require very expensive offshore drilling. And I think what we saw about a year ago with the Gulf and BP, underscores some of the issues with that offshore drilling.
If I could interject at this time, we would welcome Senator Huggins, the Resources Committee.
Thank you. Some of the issues with heavy oil and its development are the fact that it's essentially surrounds its viscosity. Because it is very viscous, it's very difficult to transport, and wells produce at a lower rate than typical conventional light oil wells. So you typically have to drill more wells to recover it, and you usually have to use some type of thermal technique, such as steam recovery or something, to get the oil out of the ground. And for California, that's not a problem, but for here in Alaska, I know you have the permafrost issue that you need to deal with. Also, heavy oil is somewhat depleted in hydrogen relative to light oil, so there's fewer products that are typically derived from it, and it sells at a lower price on the open market than conventional oil, so that economic balance is typically held back heavy oil development. Alaskan oil is somewhat unique. You have, again, about 33 billion barrels of oil in place, and between the West Sac and the Ugnew Fields, you have a kind of a grading viscosity, everywhere from syrupy oil in the West Sac all the way up to honey, almost like peanut butter, in the Ugnew Fields. However, there's BP, for example, has begun to be successfully develop and produce heavy oil at its Milne Point SPAT using the CHOPS process. So there's been work in developing, actually getting the oil out of the ground. The solution that we think we have to the problem is supercritical water extraction and refining. And essentially what that is we use the unique properties of water at very high temperatures and pressures beyond its critical point to essentially dissolve the heavy oil. It's very unique. Oil dissolves completely water past its critical point. And then we use those high temperatures and pressures to thermally crack the oil. For example, we take these very long chains, complex molecules, C12, C50s, C60s and higher, and we actually thermally crack that oil down to smaller C chains, like C5s and C6s, which are really the higher value components of conventional oil. And we do that by the high energy of the water, essentially just tearing it apart. And then water at those temperatures also provides some of the hydrogen that you need in order to get the hydrogen value up. So it's very unique in that respect.
So, interject, Doctor. So the work that you did in the area of plutonium, were you using the supercritical water? You were using that to essentially destroy or remove the hydrocarbons from the source. And so if you could explain more on how that process relates to this process. In other words, what's the idea?
Oh, excellent question. Essentially, what you can do is run supercritical water oxidation. It basically can completely destroy organics. It can take a fairly complex organic to carbon dioxide. So you get almost complete conversion. And so what you do is you just don't run the conversion all the way to complete. You use it to break up the molecule enough to get the molecules that you want, the C5s and the C6s, and then you stop. And that's essentially the process. Or if you need to, you can go all the way to the end and produce carbon dioxide. In fact, the military has licensed a variant of this type of process for chemical weapons disposal. That's how complete you can run this process. So what we've done is we've carefully looked at the conditions to get to the point where we just get enough thermal degradation to get the products of value.
Maybe I'm jumping ahead here, but maybe you could explain it to me. So the heavy oil is 5,000 feet under the ground. Are you going in and mining that heavy oil and then putting it through a process, or are you injecting water into the ground, or how's the process work?
Oh, through the chair. Essentially, what we intend to do is integrate with the current process that BP is using, the cold heavy oil production with sand. And what they do is they have these large progressive cavity pumps that they put downhole, and they pump the material out, and essentially with the sand. Now, that has some advantages and disadvantages. The advantage is that it's been thoroughly tested in Canada in their oil sand, so they're using that experience. The disadvantage is that you don't get all of the oil. You leave a fair amount of oil in place. So if you go the next step and use thermal recovery techniques, much like they've developed in California, where you take steam and inject it down into the reservoir, essentially melt the oil and then pump it out, you can get much higher recovery. The nice thing about our process is that we can either use the steam that's pumped down whole as it comes out in our process, or the process generates a fair amount of waste heat that we could use to heat steam then to inject downhole to help recovery. So there's a couple of different facets that we could do to integrate with the production.
Thank you. Yeah, just to follow up. So basically you pump up the heavy oil that you can. The rest you're essentially pumping in steam, and the steam separates or makes the oil more viscous or less viscous?
Through the chair. What we do is that when the oil comes off the wellhead, that's when we mix it with the steam. And so right at the wellhead, then the steam reacts with the oil to make the less viscous. So before it enables the transport then to the pipeline and through the pipeline. We can integrate, if you want to inject it downhole, we can integrate with that process, or we can integrate with CHOPS that doesn't use that. So the process is flexible enough to go either way. But right now, the plan was to integrate with CHOPS and inject it at the wellhead as it comes up.
Senator French.
Mr. Chairman, fascinating idea. What becomes of the water that you've now injected into the oil? I'm using layman's terms, but you're putting steam into the oil. You're breaking it down a more viscous or a less viscous material. Is it pulled out at the refinery, or where does the water move?
Through the chair. This is an excellent question. This is kind of a neat part about this process. At above the critical point, it's essentially a single phase. You can't tell the difference. you know, when you have oil and water, you typically mix. You get the two. You can actually see the two. This becomes a single phase. You can't tell the difference. When you drop it below the critical point, water then behaves like normal water, and the two essentially separate very cleanly. In fact, I have a couple of photos here later that I can show you just how clean it separates. And then all you do is you just use a gravity settler, and you can just skim it off.
But water would stay combined with the oil through shipment down taps.
Oh no, we intend to recycle the water at the wellhead so that you can keep your water usage low. And that way the low viscosity oil then can be transported without the water. There may be trace amounts left, but that's easily removed at the refinery or later on. So it shouldn't be a problem for transport.
How much water do you anticipate to use, say, per barrel or per 1,000 barrels? And then I assume you're heating the water with natural gas, and how much natural gas do you have any anticipation of how much you use?
Through the chair, what we intend to do is it depends on the oil feed. So it'll be somewhere between 2 to 3 barrels of water per barrel of oil, but we recycle the water so that the overall water usage is fairly low. What we intend to do is use electric heaters to heat it up to get the reaction going, and then the reaction itself gives off a fair amount of heat. So we intend to use the reaction of the oil in the reactor to actually get the heat. So the overall energy use is relatively low. If you look at this in comparison to a typical refinery, the kinds of energy use in a refinery, we're probably right in the middle to the lower end of energy use per barrel produced. So kind of like what a distillation column might be to try to give you an idea of comparison.
Just like real quick, just megawatts, how many megawatts of power do you anticipate would need?
For the 25 barrel per day unit, the heaters themselves will be 225 kilowatts to get the temperature up to where we need it. But then once we start the reaction generates about 220 kilowatts.
Just I'd like the record to reflect Representative Pruitt has joined us. Welcome.
Sorry, I guess I'm still a little bit unclear on the process here. Injecting steam. Thick oil comes out of the ground in a well bore, comes out of the tree. You're injecting steam at that point, making it nice and light. And the oil stays light as long as the water's still in it?
It's now upgraded. Yes, it's conventional oil. In fact, this just gives you an idea of the oil starts off like peanut butter. And then essentially what you get is this the light phase floating on top of the water. And it's the same viscosity. And you can see at that clear interface, once you separate those two, the oil is essentially like water. So you can pump it like water. And now you can separate that water phase and take it back and reuse it.
So it's the reaction that upgrades the oil at the wellhead. Water then is almost a waste product.
It's a reagent, and we just recycle it.
There, the pad in a separator.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Doctor. Please continue.
Okay. So, by using the water and using it to react the oil and get, let me just give you an example. Here is where we took some roofing asphalt that has sand intentionally added to provide a mat when you repair roofs. And this material is about the consistency of sticky, creamy peanut butter. So you can see after it's been through our process, you can see the sand settled at the bottom. You can see the water phase and then the upgraded oil floating on top. And then we pull the top off so that you can see, the oil phase and the water phase. And this is essentially the product that you get. So now you can easily separate those phases, reuse the water, and then put the oil in the pipeline and pump it essentially like like water. And this just gives you the idea of how much we can reduce the viscosity. Typically you use centipoise or something like that to kind of rank the viscosity. So you can think of it as something about a million centipoise is what's in the ground. And we take that down to water, which is like 1 to 10 centipoise. So that's like 5 orders of magnitude improvement in the viscosity. And so now you can leverage the current infrastructure that you have for the pipeline and continue to use that and open up these fields for development. Oh, I'm sorry.
Senator Wagner.
So what, you're a PhD chemist.
Yes, sir.
Tell us chemically what happens to the oil that makes it, not only makes it lighter and changes the viscosity, but allows it to continue to What's the process? Is it changing the molecular structure? What process does that go through?
Yes, sir. That's absolutely right. Through the chair? That's absolutely correct. These large heavy oil molecules are large, sometimes up to C100. They have 100 carbon molecules in chains and rings. And essentially what the water does at these very high temperatures and pressures, it's a very aggressive environment, and it literally just tears these things apart. And as it tears them apart and fractures them, you can think of a glass breaking, and when the glass breaks and you get these little fragments, as you break it and break it and break it, you can break it to get about the chain lengths and the sizes that you want. And so what you want is the distribution that you would typically get in conventional oil. And as you break them, you have these open ends that combine with the available hydrogen that's now produced in the water. Because at these high temperatures and pressures, the water actually has hydrogen that's available for reacting with these broken ends, then that increases the hydrogen. So in that molecular action of tearing them apart, you actually get the spread of sizes that you want to get that now looks just like conventional lighter oil.
It does,
and so what we do is we then have a small makeup stream that we use, and that we just, so you recycle most of it, and then you have a small makeup, and then you bleed a small amount off so that any sulfur or metallic impurities that you take out, then you can continually purge those, recycle most of the water, and then you have a small makeup that you use to keep kind of a continuous process.
Doctor, you brought up the topic of sulfur, and that's obviously one of the critical issues that people are talking about right now. If you could expand on the extraction of sulfur as part of this process that you've thought of, and just explain what that means.
Well, again, it's very dependent on the type of oil that you have. And the oil will have different, it has sulfur compounds in actually sulfur bound up in the complex structure of the molecule. And what we do is as you break that up, those bonds tend to be weaker sometimes than the carbon-hydrogen or carbon-carbon bonds. So you actually break those sometimes quicker than you break the other bonds. And then it reacts with the water to make a variety of different compounds then that are soluble in the water phase and not in the oil phase. So when you separate and you get this nice clean water and oil phase, you get the sulfur compounds in the water. And you can bleed a small amount off and take that to waste treatment or disposal and then bleed a small amount in. We don't completely, because it's very, very complex molecules, we don't completely understand all the reactions. But we know that they are weaker, and that as long as we run the process within the right conditions, we get pretty good sulfur removal. Depending on the compounds, 50 to 60% of the sulfur removed.
If you could please continue.
So a fairly dramatic reduction in viscosity, which is exactly what you would like to have, because now BP is doing a great job of producing heavy oil at the Milne Point S pad, but they have to use conventional oil to essentially dissolve the heavy oil to get the viscosity where they need to go. Well, now we believe we have a technology that could take us directly to that at the wellhead without having to do blending. Now you get a lot more volume of material that could go inside in the pipeline. Now, this process right now doesn't use any exotic equipment. We don't have to have proprietary catalysts. We don't have to have any equipment that's unusual for the petrochemical industry. Here's essentially an engineering drawing which shows the layout of a typical process.
Let the record reflect we've been joined by Senator Stevens. Mm-hmm.
So as you can see, it fits in. This is a 8x8x20 common transportainer. This is essentially the 25 barrel per day unit, which is kind of the base industrial size that we would intend to actually put out into the field. So you can see it's just very common equipment. It's shell and tube heat exchanger, typical valves, high pressure pumps, and the things that are very familiar to the petrochemical industry. This is our engineering layout for the 5 barrel per day pilot process that we're proposing to develop in order to develop the technology from the bench scale that it is now to being industrially ready. And again, these are two standard 8x8x20 foot transportainers. One is to just house the individuals that would be working with the equipment. The other houses the equipment itself. Again, you can see that it's just very common pieces of industrial equipment. We would like to develop collaborations with the University of Alaska so that we can tap into the Petroleum Development Laboratory and their expertise and use the facilities at the Fairbanks Pipeline Training Center and use their expertise as well. Since we'd be working to fill the pipeline, we'd like to tap into that expertise that's already there that would allow us to help. And this is just kind of our looking at the pipeline center grounds and how the five barrel per day pilot would essentially sit on those grounds and be integrated into the facility.
So, Doctor, have you directly contacted the university and the pipeline training center?
Yes, sir, we have. I've had an ongoing dialogue with Dr. Sharice Patel and his associates. And my associate, Mr. Jerry Myers, has contacted the individuals running the pipeline school. In fact, is meeting with them soon to get a plot plan to actually finally place the 5 barrel per day unit on the plot plan for the facility so we can begin to plan for that. So our path forward, or what we believe is a path forward, and the collaborations that we think are important for the success of the project are clearly to develop collaborations with the University of Alaska and Fairbanks Pipeline School. They have enormous experience and knowledge that would help us tremendously as we look to integrate this with the production process and how we actually get it out of the ground, and then how we interface with the actual oil field operations and everything in the field. So it would be a tremendous asset to us in the successful completion of this project. We would like to build and test a 5 barrel per day unit, which we think would give us a lot of the industrial scale experience. Mother Nature has a way of not cooperating with you in the laboratory, so there are certain unknowns that we need to answer going up to the higher scale. And again, leverage that expertise and integrate with the operations experience. And then we would like to go to a 25 barrel, use that experience to go to a 25 barrel per day unit, which we think is the smallest industrial, you can think of it, block. And you can almost then make blocks, make a lot of these blocks and fit them together depending on the production assets that you have in the field. And because those blocks would be built in the Fairbanks area, there would be a lot of jobs associated with the fabrication and the deployment of these blocks. And you can think of them as, depending on the well, you'd build 2 or 3 of these blocks and then just park them and integrate with the wellhead operations. Again, we can build them any size we think we need. We just chose that as a convenient way to get a standardized process for getting into the field. Now, we believe our process adds value because, again, we reduce the viscosity to allow transportation through conventional pipelines without heating it, without additional refining, without having to add solvents and everything that then have to be removed and replaced. Yes, sir.
When you get through a process and separate the water off, what temperature is your oil at?
It's about somewhere between 350 to maybe 400 degrees Fahrenheit. And, yeah, it's pretty hot. So we may need to, depending on the facilities that they want to take it into, we might have to even remove some more waste heat from it before it goes. Or blend it. And at that, at those temperatures, it would make a great blend stock. It actually, when you reduce the viscosity, remove the sulfur, metallic impurities, and the other facet that we found, and again, I talked about neutralizing the naphthenic acid so that it reduces the corrosion in the pipeline, you actually increase the value of the oil because now you have lighter components, the value of the oil is higher. And originally, we were looking to develop this for the California heavy oil fields. Now, they have extensive infrastructure for developing their heavy oil. They have steam-assisted gravity drainage that they use. They have a special high-speed train, heated train, to transport a lot of the oil. And they're still profitable, but we felt like this process, if we could increase the value of a barrel of oil by $15 or $20 and then keep the processing cost within that delta, that would be a real boon to the California market because now they'd be making more per barrel of oil for the same, essentially the same infrastructure cost. So you actually get, you increase the value. One of the other things that we've discovered is as you break the molecules up and you actually make more molds of this material, you increase the volume slightly by about 9%. So you actually get a few more barrels of oil out the end than you put in the front end. So again, that's another way to get additional value out of the resource.
So 100 barrels becomes 109 barrels of higher value oil.
Yes, sir.
We could stop for one moment. We would welcome Representative Osterman to Senate Resources. Welcome, Representative Osterman.
Thank you. So essentially, by having the additional value, now that we hope the economics would be in your favor, so now you could develop assets that weren't necessarily feasible before. And again, with Alaska, with billions of barrels of this asset in place, this could be a tremendous boon to the state of Alaska. In fact, we believe, and
I was just going to ask you on that point. Have you modeled any sort of financial models to estimate what it would cost per barrel to extract?
Yes, we have. And again, it depends on the production process that you use and some of the things like that. So the price varies, but we believe it's somewhere between a low end of where you have a fully developed infrastructure, you're already injecting steam down hole, so you have a lot of things in place, about $10 per barrel, up to maybe $13 or $14 per barrel where you don't have that and you're having to have the capital costs and to add that to the project.
So that would be added cost onto what the cost already is?
That's correct.
Do you have an idea of what the cost is for heavy oil extraction in Canada, for instance? What does it typically cost to extract using sort of conventional methods that there are out there today? And how does your price compare to those costs?
Through the chair?
Certainly, Doctor.
I don't have a very good cost for that. I can tell you, though, that they've invested over just recently in one of their salt. What they do is they dig up the sand and they use a retorting process where they heat it up and then a solvent extraction that they essentially dissolve the material out and then they have to remove it. And they just invested $10 billion in a new facility to do that. And they're still able to be economically effective at that. So their capital facilities are very, very expensive. We envision a smaller, more distributed processing that allows you to more tailor make it to the field and the production process rather than these massive billion dollars facilities that are in one place and now I have to transport oil and to have enough oil flowing in the facility to keep it viable. We believe that, there's a real positive impact for the state with the successful development of this technology. It provides 12% of U.S. oil through the pipeline, and that's incredibly important to the U.S. economy. We believe that we could maintain, perhaps increase, revenue from the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and then the associated benefits of that are the jobs and the oil field development, and then perhaps new jobs associated with the steer processing itself, and maintain the revenue stream for the state. And Alaska has these vast, I mean, billions of barrels of unconventional oil reserves, which we believe could be a real revenue source for the state for decades to come, and that would be very important. But it would really need to break this barrier down of this viscosity issue in transport, I think, to really be effective. Again, I've talked a little bit about myself and told you a little bit about my background and how that kind of led to the idea itself. I also have a Mr. Jerry Myers from Heavy Oil Solutions who's been a partner and been helping with understanding the Alaska part of this and the environment. And then Ms. Michelle Hooft of Heavy Oil Solution who's been helping with some of the business development. And then again, we believe very important relationships to the University of Alaska Petroleum Development Laboratory and the Fairbanks Pipeline Training Facility. So in conclusion, we believe that the technology, if properly developed and successful, could provide more oil for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And this has a variety of positive effects. We know we can reduce the viscosity from honey to water. We've demonstrated it in the laboratory. We believe we understand the chemistry reasonably well. Now we're looking to take that the next step to the higher throughput. Leverages the investment in conventional pipeline trucks and refineries and makes that last much longer. And the design itself is based on industrial proven technologies. Like I talked about, supercritical water oxidation of industrial waste. It uses standard petrochemical equipment and standard commodity chemicals. So there's nothing there that's unusual that we don't know, we don't understand the environmental effects of, we don't know the costs. So it's we think that the development will be relatively straightforward from the bench scale. Now that concludes my prepared presentation. Are there any other questions that I can answer?
Ultimately, one of the questions is what is it that you would like the legislature to consider? You're presenting this, which I think is very exciting new technology, and hopefully opens up an entire new universe in Alaska oil production. But what would you like the legislature to think about?
Well, we would like for you to consider perhaps a capital investment in the development of the process. And we believe that's good for the state because rather than going directly to an oil company where then they would perhaps own the technology or believe they owned it and want to perhaps use it, that this would allow a diverse licensing structure and a diversity of applications for the state and therefore be a real good return. So we would be looking for some capital investment from the state on this behalf.
Senator Wagner,
I was going to ask you what's your estimated price of building the demonstration unit?
Right now, we're working through trying to get a very precise set of numbers. I'm very fortunate that we have Vernon Broyles from TCI Construction, who has Alaska experienced engineers. Right now, we're working very closely with two of his engineers to come up with a reasonably precise cost estimate that we hope to have within the week. And I think we can have a good answer for you, sir.
Thank you.
One
other question.
Follow-up question.
You were talking a little bit about the licensing and the use of this technology. If the state became involved, do you plan to retain the ownership
of the process yourself, and how you see this all working, because you've I think you've implied to me that you're not going to sell this right now to a oil company, this process.
Through the chair, and I may ask Mr. Jerry Myers to help me, but the current plans now are to form an Alaska company and then to essentially pass the license to the Alaska company so that they would be able to exercise it on behalf of that company for deployment here in the state.
Dr. Yarborough, thank you very much. Anyway, I think this is exciting time. Maybe this is technology that can efficiently and economically open up billions and tens of billions of barrels of crude oil in our Central North Slope region and start filling up the pipeline.
Thank you, Senator. Again, let me thank all of you for your valuable time. It was a real privilege to come up here and visit Juneau and have the opportunity to present to you, and I really want to thank you for that opportunity.
With that, we will conclude this Wednesday, January 18th session of the Senate Resources Committee. We are adjourned.